When the words pregnancy and choice are used, we usually think of abortion. But the editors of an essay collection about reproduction called Choice have interpreted that word much more broadly. Their book includes 24 moving personal stories about surrogacy, adoption, single parenthood, childlessness, and abortion that Vanity Fair has praised as stunningly honest. Joining me now are editors Karen E. Bender and Nina DeGramont, and they'll be joined by phone by Kimmy Faxon Hemingway, one of the book's contributors. It's published by McAdam Cage, and I'm very pleased that it brings Karen Bender, Nina DeGramont, and Kimmy Faxon Hemingway to the show today. Hello.
Hi. Thanks.
Karen or Nina, you have written in your introduction that you hope these stories will help readers better understand how complex and contradictory decisions about pregnancy can be. Is it your hope that these personal stories will allow readers to empathize with the authors in a way that they might not otherwise be able to? Karen?
Yeah, I think one thing, we started the book New Year's Eve 2005 when South Dakota had just proposed a ban on all abortions in the state. And we found this very intolerant and surprising to us, and that we'd only experienced abortion as legal, you know, in our lives. So we thought, as writers, it would be really interesting to use story as a way to create bridges between people.
And Nina, often these issues are reduced to little more than bumper sticker slogans like "Choose life," "Your mother did," or "Keep your laws off my body."
Yes.
But when you read these things, you realize that these are really complicated issues.
Yes, and you can't really reduce it to theory. It's much more, you can think about it in much more accurate and compassionate ways when you're presented with actual situations and scenarios and stories. We had an event that was sponsored by Planned Parenthood, and we learned a story about one of the lobbyists in South Dakota for that abortion ban. And she was pregnant with twins at the time, and then discovered that one of the twins had severe genetic abnormalities and it was imperiling the pregnancy. And she ended up reducing that pregnancy to save the viable twin.
Even though she was on the other side of the abortion debate.
Yes, and she saved her, she changed her politics. And it was essentially, you know, a situation which she couldn't possibly have imagined. And if you present the issue in terms of these situations, people tend to think about it very differently.
Right. Well, Kimmy, your story, like many of the others in this book, is really painful to read. Had you written previously about your terrible experiences with RU486, the French abortion drug?
I had, but very unsuccessfully. I was writing on the heels of the experience when I initially drafted my story, and I think I did that not necessarily with the intention of finding an audience for it, but just as a way to make sense of what I was living through. And then I did a very stupid thing, which is that I brought that first draft to a creative writing workshop, and it was, you know, it's the taboo of all teachers and writers that, you know, don't use writing as a therapist's couch, but I was doing that. And it didn't work because I hadn't found the real story yet. I hadn't discovered how I felt about the experience. I hadn't made sense of it. I didn't have perspective. So,
and the writing didn't help you work that out?
Well, the writing did help, but it was more in the effort to create a log and sort of a testimony, I think, to what I was going through. But it was still unresolved. You know, I still hadn't healed. I wasn't healthy, and so I was just in the midst of it in a way that limited my perspective.
Well, let's get to the story. Many people celebrated when RU486 was approved in the United States after many years of opposition. Can you tell us about your experiences with the drug?
Yeah, sure. I had gone to an abortion clinic, a women's clinic in North Carolina, seeking an abortion, but I thought I was going for a medical abortion until I learned about RU486. And I think, and as I write in the essay, on a political level, it was something that I could really get behind. I felt, this is progress. This is an amazing thing that I have this choice within the right to choose abortion. And then on top of that, the practitioners at this clinic presented the drug to me as this way that I could end the pregnancy that was, to use their terms, organic, natural, almost like a miscarriage. And because I was really terrified of my situation and having to finally confront the fact that, you know, I was a woman who had always been fervently pro-choice, and then suddenly here I was, I had to act on this belief that I held so true to my core. So, and, you know, also a certain part of me is very private, and I thought, well, the drug sounds like the easy way to go. And so I took, at the clinic, at that visit, I orally took two tablets of mifepristone, which is the drug, the initial drug that's used, produced by Danko Labs. And then when I got home 2 days after the visit, I vaginally inserted misoprostol, which expels the pregnancy. So the first drug is a progesterone blocker. The second drug acts as kind of a vehicle to, you know, remove the contents of the uterus.
So that's the way it's usually done.
Yeah.
But
well,
it didn't,
no, actually, it had been. Some clinics administer the drug that way. But in 2006, the FDA learned that certain clinics were using this kind of management, that they were prescribing women to vaginally insert the second drug, and then they came out with this, or they released information saying that they had never endorsed usage that way. That, you know, it may or may not be safe, but that their clinical trials didn't test the efficacy of the drug to be the second set of drugs to be inserted vaginally. And
it didn't work for you. You had an incomplete abortion. It left you very sick.
Right, right. I developed horrific infections and was very, very sick, very weak for many, many weeks. And by the time I had, you know, a DNC, it was three months had passed since I had originally taken the drug.
Well, you didn't receive medical care that you desperately needed for several months until you fainted at an airport.
Mm-hmm.
Why weren't you able to see a doctor before that? You knew that you weren't feeling well.
I was seeing doctors. I had returned to the clinic, and I had a number of ultrasounds and that indicated that the pregnancy, you know, I was no longer pregnant. The early ultrasounds, or at least that was what the sonographers whom I saw told me, that I was just carrying what they said was tissue, and that my body would eventually just, you know, absorb or release it, and that, you know, it was just a matter of waiting. But that turned into, you know, many, many instances of hemorrhaging, and I found finally a very compassionate doctor in my town who, he said, you know, this is not an innocuous drug. This is a drug still in its discovery phases. So he was monitoring me very closely and did not want to administer a DNC because of the risk of scarring and infertility at that point. And so when I finally fainted, I had been visiting my family in Massachusetts and was on my way back to North Carolina, and I went to a hospital in Boston. And one doctor there said, the thing is, we just don't know what a uterus looks like 3 months after taking RU486. In other words, there's just not that much research, or, you know, I think with incomplete RU486 abortions, there just has not been that much research.
Were you aware that your mother had been through an illegal abortion herself, a botched one, before she became pregnant with you?
I was aware of
so
that.
Could you have talked about this with her?
Yes, and I did talk about it with her, and she was very, very concerned about my health and well-being, and wanted me, you know, obviously to seek proper medical help, and so she was incredibly supportive and wise. But I think she also was frustrated with me because I concealed a lot of what was happening from her, because I didn't want her to worry, you know. So I would sort of keep it private, keep it to myself.
Karen, when you were putting together this book, did you hear other stories, similar stories from women about this?
About RU486?
Yeah.
we didn't find other stories about RE46. We found a lot of, you know, different experiences with abortion. Some, you know, were not complicated. Some were more complicated.
But I would assume that people who have trouble with a drug like this might be reluctant to talk about it because they don't want to come across as being anti-choice.
Right,
and
yes.
Kimmy, I suspect that was your case as well. You didn't want people to think that that this could be used as an example of why this drug should not be prescribed.
Absolutely. I mean, that was always in the back of my head. I was always resisting, I think, you know, making the essay public in any way because I was so worried about that. And though just like Nina and Karen, I think that the intention for the book, I wanted also to show how it is incredibly difficult. It is much easier to, you know, talk the talk than it is to walk the walk. I mean, sorry to speak in cliches, but it was such an incredibly difficult thing to go through, and it made me reevaluate my feelings about abortion, and they certainly didn't change. I remain pro-choice and committed to that, though, you know, I just like the lobbyist in South Dakota, your politics can be challenged when you go through, when politics are made personal. So, though I did do an interview, after the book's publication with someone who the interviewer said that I expressed that concern off the record that I was worried I would give energy to the pro-life movement by writing my story, and she said, well, ultimately it does.
Well, so, Nina, Kimmy also said that she's a private person, and
right.
yet many of the stories in this book, which are extremely personal, are written under the person's real name. Only one of them uses a pseudonym.
Yes.
Because the writers wanted their experiences to be made public?
Well, I think one of the things that we discovered is that these are issues women really want to discuss and talk about. I mean, we found out when we called for the essays, and, you know, even though it was our idea, we were astonished at how honest people were willing to be.
And when you call for the essays, where did you call for them? Because not everyone can write.
Right. Well, initially we approached writers whom we admired.
And had they all had experiences, or many of them had experiences along these lines?
Well, we approached writers who had broached it in their writing. For example, Pam Houston had, you know, mentioned in her writing that she had had more than one abortion. Jacqueline Michard, we knew, had a very large and, you know, complexly
created family.
So
which we'll get to.
Her.
That's the author of the bestseller The Deep End of the Ocean and five other bestselling novels.
Her story was amazing. I mean,
don't tell it now.
Actually,
we're going to take a little break.
Okay.
And we'll come back. We'll talk about hers and some of the others. Janet Mason Ellaby's story, for example.
Yeah.
And we'll be back with more from Kimmy. Kimmy Faxon Hemingway is one of the contributors to a book called Choice, which is published by McAdam Cage. We're talking with her along with the book's editors, Karen E. Bender and Nina de Grammont.
WNYC receives support from the Valley Hospital Spine Center, providing specialized care for back or neck pain caused by injury, deformity, or degenerative conditions. Services include neurosurgery and orthopedic surgery. More at 201-251-3491. Brilliant Earth Conflict-Free Diamonds, tapping ethical, eco-friendly sources in Canada and supporting local diamond communities in Africa. BrilliantEarth.com. Luxury with a conscience. The stage comedy Boeing Boeing, now coming to Broadway after a run in London. Boeing Boeing tells the story of a bachelor with three flight attendant fiancés. Tickets at boeingonbroadway.com or telecharge.com.
This is WNYC, New York Public Radio on AM/FM, and now available as a podcast, too. Forget mariachis, think electronica and emo today on Soundcheck. As Mexican-Americans celebrate Cinco de Mayo, hear what musical styles are booming back home and what they may change, why they may change your postcard image of Mexico. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. We're We're back with the editors of a book called Choice, which is published by McAdam Cage, Karen Bender, and Nina DeGramont, and also with one of the book's contributors, Kimmy Faxon Hemingway. These are all essays that cover a wide range of reproductive issues. One of the most moving stories here is by Janet Mason Ellaby, who got pregnant at 16, the first time she ever had sex, and her parents sent her to a home for unwed mothers. Do you have any idea when that story took place? It must have been before 60, Roe v.
Yeah.
Wade?
Yeah, it was 65.
Yeah, early 60s.
Do homes for unwed mothers still exist today? Do you know?
You know, in fact, there's still a Florence Crittenden home in Charlotte, North Carolina, far from where we live.
She wrote that she felt she had no choice about what happened to her or her baby, and that she felt the loss of her daughter for the rest of her life.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, that's a pretty common story, but a teenager gives up her baby for adoption and then pines after the child, often tries to find out where the child went.
Right.
But do you think it matters whether the baby is taken away immediately as opposed to being allowed to bond for a while?
Well, I think in Janet's case, she wasn't even aware of her rights. Like, she actually had the right to refuse to give her child up for adoption, and she didn't know. I mean, they just had her sign some papers, and later when she found out she could have kept the baby, she was just outraged. It's a really, really powerful story, I think, in terms of, you know, the pro-life movement saying it's so, you know, just adoption, it's so easy, you know, that's the easy choice to make, you know, life. And you see the human fallout from that in her essay.
Well, I get the feeling from this book that there are no easy choices to
absolutely.
Make. That people feel very, women feel very ambivalent about having abortions and sometimes pine after that lost child, even though it was didn't come to term. And people who give up children for adoption, people who are surrogate mothers who connect to the babies that are in their bodies. I mean, this is a lot of the stuff is to do with chemicals all rushing through our bodies that we have no control over.
And it's so personal. And I think that was one of our points in the book politically, is that the idea that this is such a personal issue, people have so many different feelings about it. Everyone has their own story and their own experience. To have the government reach in a hand and try and force a decision one way or another, it just seems incomprehensible.
And just intolerant and devoid of compassion. I mean, to speak to what you and Kimmy were talking about earlier, we really wanted to, put this book together under the premise that reproductive rights should be a given.
Right.
And because the most basic landmark, Roe v. Wade, is so constantly under attack, there can't be progress within reproductive rights because we're stuck defending that original first step.
So you've taken a position, but I could see some people who are opposed to abortion also finding stories here that they could focus on.
Yes,
well, let's talk a bit about Jacqueline Richard.
Yeah.
Can you tell us that story?
That was an amazing story. We had no idea she had a story like this. She has many children, and we contacted her, and she said, yes, I have a story I want to tell. She had in vitro IVF, and she had some frozen embryos that she just couldn't get rid of. She just didn't want to she wanted to use them, and so she found a woman who would act as a surrogate, and
Bobby Joe,
right? And she lived in a small southern town, and everything seemed to be going well, and then there was a glitch. And
what happened to Bobby Joe?
Her husband changed his mind. Essentially, he had agreed to the procedure, agreed to allow his wife to act as a surrogate. They had two children of their own. And he started getting teased and ribbed and accused by people he knew, by his family and by friends, and suddenly decided that she had committed adultery by going through with the surrogacy, and he left her.
This was adultery?
In his mind. And you know,
was he supported by neighbors, by other people in the community?
He was supported by neighbors, and in fact, ultimately, he was supported by a family court judge who gave him full custody of her children.
Right. That was the fallout in terms of the judicial system, which was just horrid. And she had to fight for custody for just carrying this embryo to term for Jacqueline Richard.
Kimmy, you talked about being a private person. What kind of reaction have you had from people who've read the book or who know your story?
A lot of support, but also I think some people are perplexed that I would disclose such incredibly personal details in kind of a graphic way, certain sections of the essay. And recently I had a woman say that to me that my essay was the only one she couldn't read in the whole collection. So that was humbling.
Did any disagree with your decision or just get upset by the story you had to tell?
Did she disagree with the decision?
Or did anyone? Did anyone say, you know, well, you should have had the baby?
Oh, no, not at all. I think it's clear that that was a choice that I was committed to. And for the most part, I have felt that, you know, readers have really honored that. Mm. What's been interesting, though, is on the book tour that Nina and I were on in North Carolina, one of a couple of our readings, two women who worked for Planned Parenthood and other women's clinics came up to me and apologized for my experience and said, you know, that should never have happened and that would not have happened at our clinic. And interestingly enough, I have a former student who works at a local Planned Parenthood who got a hold of my essay and wrote me the most sensitive, supportive email saying, you know, I sometimes lose sight of what it is like to be the one having the abortion, you know, because I'm so wrapped up in the clinical aspect of administering abortions or giving women, you know, the necessary information, et cetera. So she said, I was so grateful to have your perspective.
Now, did you talked about having problems getting this down on paper in the right way. What finally got you through?
This is going to sound very strange, but it was getting pregnant that got me through.
And you suddenly understood how to write the piece?
Yeah, I think I had this sense of myself on the page as a persona as opposed to me. You know, it was a version of me, but it wasn't me living the experience and that. And suddenly I knew that I was okay. I could get pregnant, even though that was something, you know, doctors told me it would be very difficult for me after what I went through. And I think I felt like I was in this sort of cocoon of safety where I could deliver my story. Yeah, so that it was really that.
My guests are Kimmy Fex and Hemingway, who's one of the contributors to a book called Choice, which is being published by McAdam Cage, and two of the editors, Karen E. Bender and Nina de Gramont. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Both you, Karen, and you, Nina, have stories as well to tell. And let's begin with Karen. You've written about your own fears of giving birth to a severely ill or handicapped child. And what led you to feel that way?
It's my own family experience. My mother's sister had many difficult issues. She was born mentally retarded, and also later she had severe emotional issues. My mother called it the double whammy. She just had many issues to deal with. She wasn't able to live on her own. And I saw the profound impact of that on a family that, you know, people may say, you know, I would, if I, you know, had an abnormal pregnancy, I would go through it. But I saw how it affected my family for her entire life and how my grandmother didn't, it was a huge struggle for her to figure out what to do, how to care for her when she was getting older and my grandmother was going to die. And also how...
I'd imagine this happens with anyone has something that something that's gone wrong in the family. Sometimes you can't even predict it. Autism, for example, occurs in families where there's been no incidence of autism before.
Yeah. And so that it's not something to be taken lightly. And again, something that you have an outside government, that, you know, outside force that says you must do it this way.
Yeah. Nina, you've written about how devastated you felt when your first pregnancy ended in miscarriage.
Right. And I guess I had a hard time reconciling that with my pro-choice beliefs because I felt such grief over the loss of, you know, this 10-week-old fetus. And I guess I just wrote about sort of coming to terms with my right to feel that grief and to have ambivalence about abortion as an issue and still be very staunch in my pro-choice stance.
What about thoughts about getting pregnant again? Obviously, that had to be in the back of your mind that you might have another miscarriage. You don't want to just go through a string of miscarriages. That can be a rather tragic situation.
Right, right. And certainly that was a concern, but I think after my miscarriage, my body overtook. I think I was just hormonally driven to get pregnant again immediately, and I did. Mm-hmm. And luckily that pregnancy went to term.
But you've written that your miscarriage has also left you uncomfortable with aborting fetuses in cases of multiple pregnancies, known as selective reduction.
Right. Well, it was interesting because it was, I guess it came out when my daughter was about a year old. There was a Lives column in the New York Times magazine by a woman who was pregnant with triplets and decided to reduce two of them. And it made me uncomfortable. At the time, I had a cousin who was having all kinds of trouble conceiving. And I don't know, when I read the essay, I felt very upset. And I found myself judging her in ways that I didn't want to be judgmental. And I remember talking to a woman about it who said, well, you can't feel that way if you're pro-choice. And I sort of thought, well, it's true that I don't want to feel this way and I kind of want to work through it, but I think I can feel that way and still be pro-choice. I think I'm entitled to that.
Because that's part of the message of this book, too, that you can have certain beliefs, but then on an emotional level, life gets a little more complicated. Absolutely. And on a personal level, it often does as well.
Right.
The story published anonymously was written by a woman who passed the gene for hemophilia on to her first son. When she became pregnant again and learned that he'd also have hemophilia, she chose to abort. Did she tell you why she wanted her identity withheld?
I think she is kind of prominent in the movement and I think she wanted her privacy there.
And she was one of the few contributors who's not an author.
Right,
So I think she was less comfortable, you know, putting her name on the essay and having that story public.
Right.
But isn't aborting a fetus that tests positive for a serious illness almost routine in most American hospitals today?
It's pretty common, certainly,
Yeah.
Although, as we're seeing more and more around the country, where abortion is either being made illegal in one way or another, or clinics are closing, that in many cases, doctors are refusing to abort even when it is illegal. Well, when it is legal.
Right. Yes, right. I actually had was discussing the book with a friend recently, and she said, this was actually in New Jersey, she said she was pregnant, she wanted this CVS test, I think it's for abnormalities, and the doctor said, would you abort if it was abnormal? And she said, yes. And he said, I don't want to do the test. And, you know.
And she has to hope she can find another doctor who will do it.
Yeah, right. So I think there is a lot of that. And in my essay, I also talk about how I was refused the morning after pill in Iowa City in the late 80s just because a doctor didn't want to give it to me. So it's out. I mean, there's a lot of discrimination that's, you know, out there that's, you know, just there.
And I think it's hard to pass legislation enforcing doctors to perform these procedures, enforcing pharmacists to, you know, give birth control pills and the morning after pills. And that's another example of the movement sort of being halted, running in place, still arguing over Roe v. Wade, so we're not able to make progress in these other areas.
Mm-hmm. And some pharmacists have won legal battles because they didn't want to prescribe, to dispense with birth control pills or morning after pills.
Right. The National Women's Law Center, which is a great website, which we consulted a lot in our research, says four states, Georgia, Mississippi, Arkansas, and South Dakota, have explicit policies that allow pharmacists to refuse to dispense drugs. Just on their own, you know, for their own reasons.
Now, we've been talking about politics quite a bit here, but you pretty much avoid discussing them in the book, although the final chapter by Francine Prose is a reflection on the language of the Roe v. Wade decision.
Right.
How concerned are you about the recent federal decision prohibiting late-term abortions?
That was really upsetting. One of the most powerful essays in the book is by a writer named Susan Ito, who's an Oakland writer. She writes about a second-term abortion, second trimester abortion. She had preeclampsia, and she was going to have a stroke if she carried her baby to term. The fetus was It was 2 weeks to viability, or
it was 20 or 22.
It was
20.
It was almost. It was almost viable. She really wanted to have it. She was a physical therapist. She said, "If I have a stroke, I can get through it. It's the most moving essay." She might have died. She had to decide.
She would have died. Her husband was a physician,
yes.
And he was there with her. And I mean, it was a matter of hours. She wanted to try to go 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And they were saying, if you don't go ahead and abort, you might not live the night.
Right.
And the essay, I mean, I challenge anybody to read that essay and not feel, it's a tragic, horrible, sad story.
Right.
But she needed that choice in place in order to survive, literally.
Right. And when people say I know a lot of people who actually say I'm pro-choice but not the second trimester, they should read that essay.
Yes.
Have you seen the Romanian film, 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days?
No, not yet.
No.
Well, it's a film about Romania during the last of the Ceausescu years, and a woman is enlisted by her rather pathetic roommate who is pregnant, who doesn't tell her that she's so late in her pregnancy, to help her find an abortionist and to arrange for an abortion, and a lot of problems occur along the way. The film, which doesn't take a position pro or con abortion, has everybody thought it was a sure thing for an Oscar, or at least for Oscar contention, but it didn't make the final cut, and the feeling is because abortion continues to remain a really contentious issue in this country.
Yeah.
Yes, and in fact, it's very rare on TV or in movies that a character will decide to have an abortion. Usually when an unplanned pregnancy is part of a storyline, the character will decide to go ahead and have the baby.
Another hit movie, Juno.
Yeah. Right, and Knocked Up.
Knocked Up.
Well, thank you. But you didn't call this book Knocked Up. You called it Choice. And I want to thank you all so much for being on our show today.
Thanks.
I've been talking with Karen E. Bender and Nina DeGramont, the editors of Choice, which is published by McAdam Cage, and one of its contributors, Kimmy Faxon Hemingway. Also in the book are Anne Hood, Pam Houston, Sarah Messer, Jacqueline Michard, Francine Prose, and 19 others. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you
for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
On tomorrow's show, Bill Moyers assesses the health of American democracy. Also, Simon Winchester on the fascinating life story of a Cambridge scientist, jockey Edgar Prado, who rode in this past Saturday's Kentucky Derby. And the latest in our Political Projections film series looks into remakes and how changing political climates affect the newer versions of old films. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angela Sheldon, Jen Poyant, and Fran Jacobs. Zach Marsh was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.